every harm. The final lines are barely audible. Here your dreams are sweet, and tomorrow brings them true. Here is the place where I love you. Everything's still and quiet. Then, almost eerily, the mockingjays take up my song. For a moment, I sit there, watching my tears drip down on her face. Ruse cannon fires. I lean forward and press my lips against her temple. Slowly, as if not to wake her, I lay her head back on the ground and release her hand. They'll want me to clear out now, so they can collect the bodies. And there's nothing to stay for. I roll the boy from District 1 onto his face, and take his pack, retrieve the arrow that ended his life. I cut Rue's pack from her back as well, knowing she'd want me to have it, but leave the spear in her stomach. Weapons in bodies will be transported to the hovercraft. I've no use for a spear, so the sooner it's gone from the arena, the better. I can't stop looking at Rue, smaller than ever, a baby animal curled up in a nest of netting. I can't bring myself to leave her like this, past harm, but seeming utterly defenseless, to hate the boy from District 1, who also appears so vulnerable in death, seems inadequate. It's the capital I hate, for doing this to all of us. Gale's voice is in my head, his ravings against the capital, no longer pointless, no longer to be ignored. Rue's death has forced me to confront my own fury against the cruelty, the injustice they inflict upon us. But here, even more strongly than at home, I feel my impotence. There's no way to take revenge on the capital. Is there? Then I remember Peter's words on the roof. Only I keep wishing I could think of a way to show the capital they don't own me, that I'm more than just a piece in their games. And for the first time, I understand what he means. I want to do something, right here, right now, to shame them, to make them accountable, to show the capital that whatever they do or force us to do, there is a part of every tribute they can't own, that Rue was more than a piece in their games. And so am I. A few steps into the woods grows a bank of wildflowers. Perhaps they are really weeds of some sort, but they have blossoms in beautiful shades of violet and yellow and white. I gather up an armful and come back to Rue's side. Slowly, one stem at a time, I decorate her body in the flowers, covering the ugly wound, wreathing her face, weaving her hair with bright colors. They'll have to show it, or even if they choose to turn the cameras elsewhere at this moment. They'll have to bring them back when they collect the bodies, and everyone will see her then, and know I did it. I step back and take a last look at Rue. She could really be asleep in that meadow after all. "Bye, Rue," I whisper. I press the three middle fingers of my left hand against my lips and hold them out in her direction. Then I walk away without looking back. The birds fall silent. Somewhere a mockingjay gives the warning whistle that precedes the hovercraft. I don't know how it knows. It must hear things that humans can't. I pause, my eyes focused on what's ahead, not what's happening behind me. It doesn't take long. Then the general bird song begins again, and I know she's gone. Another mockingjay, a young one by the look of it, lands on a branch before me and bursts out Rue's melody. My song, the hovercraft, were too unfamiliar for this novice to pick up, but it has mastered her handful of notes, the ones that mean she's safe. "Good and safe," I say as I pass under its branch. "We don't have to worry about her now. Good and safe." I've no idea where to go. The brief sense of home I had that one night with Rue has vanished. My feet wander this way and that until sunset. I'm not afraid, not even watchful, which makes me an easy target, except I'd kill anyone I met on sight, without emotion or the slightest tremor in my hands. My hatred of the capital has not lessened my hatred of my competitors in the least, especially the careers. They, at least, can be made to pay for Rue's death. No one materializes, though. There aren't many of us left, and it's a big arena. Soon they'll be pulling out some other device to force us together. But there's been enough gore today. Perhaps we'll even get to sleep. I'm about to haul my packs into a tree to make camp when a silver parachute floats down and lands in front of me, a gift from a sponsor. But why now? I've been in fairly good shape with supplies. Maybe Haymitch has noticed my despondency and is trying to cheer me up a bit. Or could it be something to help my ear? I open the parachute and find a small loaf of bread. It's not the fine white capital stuff. It's made of dark ration grain and shaped in a crescent, sprinkled with seeds. I flash back to Peter's lesson on the various district breads in the training center. This bread came from District 11. I cautiously lift the still warm loaf. What must it have cost the people of District 11 who can't even feed themselves? How many would have had to do without to scrape up a coin to put in the collection for this one loaf? It had been meant for Rue, surely. But instead of pulling the gift when she died, they authorized Haymitch to give it to me. As a thank you? Or because, like me, they don't like to let debts go unpaid. For whatever reason, this is a first. A district gift to a tribute who's not your own. I lift my face and step into the last falling rays of sunlight. My thanks to the people of District 11, I say. I want them to know I know where it came from, that the full value of their gift has been recognized. I climb dangerously high into a tree, not for safety, but to get as far away from today as I can. My sleeping bag is rolled neatly in Rue's pack. Tomorrow I'll sort through the supplies. Tomorrow I'll make a new plan. But tonight all I can do is strap myself in and take tiny bites of the bread. It's good. It tastes of home. Soon the seals in the sky, the anthem plays in my right ear. I see the boy from District 1, Rue. That's all for tonight. Six of us left, I think. Only six. With the bread still locked in my hands, I fall asleep at once. Sometimes when things are particularly bad, my brain will give me a happy dream, a visit with my father in the woods, an hour of sunlight and cake with Prim. Tonight it sends me Rue, still decked in her flowers, perched in a high sea of trees, trying to teach me to talk to the mockingjays. I see no sign of her wounds, no blood, just a bright, laughing girl. She sings songs I've never heard in a clear, melodic voice. On and on, through the night. There's a drowsy in-between period when I can hear the last few strains of her music, although she's lost in the leaves. When I fully awaken, I'm momentarily comforted. I try to hold on to the peaceful feeling of the dream, but it quickly slips away, leaving me sadder and lonelier than ever. Heaviness infuses my whole body, as if there's liquid lead in my veins. I've lost the will to do the simplest tasks, to do anything but lie here, staring unblinkingly through the canopy of leaves. For several hours, I remain motionless. As usual, it's the thought of Prim's anxious face as she watches me on the screens back home that breaks me from my lethargy. I give myself a series of simple commands to follow, like, "Now you have to sit up, Katniss. Now you have to drink water, Katniss." I act on the orders with slow, robotic motions. "Now you have to sort the packs, Katniss." Rue's pack holds my sleeping bag, her nearly empty water skin, a handful of nuts and roots, a bit of rabbit, her extra socks, and her slingshot. The boy from District 1 has several knives, two spare spearheads, a flashlight, a small leather pouch, a first aid kit, a full bottle of water, and a pack of dried fruit. A pack of dried fruit. Out of all he might have chosen from. To me, this is a sign of extreme arrogance. Why bother to carry food when you have such a bounty back at camp? When you will kill your enemy so quickly, you'll be home before you're hungry? I can only hope the other careers traveled so lightly when it came to food, and now find themselves with nothing. Speaking of which, my own supply is running low. I finish off the loaf from District 11, and the last of the rabbit. How quickly the food disappears. All I have left are Rue's roots and nuts, the boy's dried fruit, and one strip of beef. Now you have to hunt, Katniss, I tell myself. I obediently consolidate the supplies I want into my pack. After I climb down the tree, I conceal the boy's knives and spearheads in a pile of rocks so that no one else can use them. I've lost my bearings, what with all the wandering around I did yesterday evening, but I try and head back in the general direction of the stream. I know I'm on course when I come across Rue's third unlit fire. Shortly thereafter, I discover a flock of grouselings perched in the trees and take out three before they know what hit them. I return to Rue's signal fire and start it up, not caring about the excessive smoke. Where are you, Cato? I think, as I roast the birds and Rue's roots. I'm waiting right here. Who knows where the careers are now, either too far to reach me or too sure this is a trick, or, is it possible, too scared of me? They know I have the bow and arrows, of course. Cato saw me take them from Glimmer's body. But have they put two and two together yet, figured out I blew up the supplies and killed their fellow career? Possibly they think Thresh did this. Wouldn't he be more likely to revenge Rue's death than I would, being from the same district? Not that he ever took any interest in her. And what about Foxface? Did she hang around to watch me blow up the supplies? No. When I caught her laughing in the ashes the next morning, it was as if someone had given her a lovely surprise. I doubt they think PETA has lit this signal fire. Cato's sure he's as good as dead. I find myself wishing I could tell PETA about the flowers I put on Rue, that I now understand what he was trying to say on the roof. Perhaps if he wins the games, he'll see me on Victor's Night, when they replay the highlights of the games on a screen over the stage where we did our interviews. The winner sits in a place of honor on the platform, surrounded by their support crew. But I told Rue I'd be there, for both of us. And somehow, that seems even more important than the vow I gave Prim. I really think I stand a chance of doing it now. Winning. It's not just having the arrows and outsmarting the careers a few times, although those things help. Something happened when I was holding Rue's hand, watching the life drain out of her. Now I am determined to revenge her, to make her loss unforgettable. And I can only do that by winning and thereby making myself unforgettable. I overcook the birds, hoping someone will show up to shoot, but no one does. Maybe the other tributes are out there beating one another senseless, which would be fine. Ever since the bloodbath, I've been featured on screens more than I care. Eventually, I wrap up my food and go back to the stream to replenish my water and gather some. But the heaviness from the morning drapes back over me, and even though it's only early evening, I climb a tree and settle in for the night. My brain begins to replay the events from yesterday. I keep seeing Rue speared, my arrow piercing the boy's neck. I don't know why I should even care about the boy. Then I realize he was my first kill. Along with other statistics they report to help people place their bets, every tribute has a list of kills. I guess technically I'd get credited for Glimmer and the girl from District 4, too, for dumping that nest on them. But the boy from District 1 was the first person I knew would die because of my actions. Numerous animals have lost their lives at my hands, but only one human. I hear Gale saying, "How different can it be, really?" Amazingly similar in the execution. A bow pulled, an arrow shot. Entirely different in the aftermath. I killed a boy whose name I don't even know. Somewhere his family is weeping for him. His friends call for my blood. Maybe he had a girlfriend who really believed he would come back. But then I think of Rue's still body, and I'm able to banish the boy from my mind. At least for now. It's been an uneventful day, according to the sky. No deaths. I wonder how long we'll get until the next catastrophe drives us back together. If it's going to be tonight, I want to get some sleep first. I cover my good ear to block out the strains of the anthem. But then I hear the trumpets and sit straight up in anticipation. For the most part, the only communication the tributes get from outside the arena is the nightly death toll, but occasionally there will be trumpets followed by an announcement. Usually, this will be a call to a feast. When food is scarce, the game makers will invite the players to a banquet, somewhere known to all like the cornucopia, as an inducement to gather and fight. Sometimes there is a feast, and sometimes there's nothing but a loaf of stale bread for the tributes to compete for. I wouldn't go in for the food, but this could be an ideal time to take out a few competitors. Claudius Temple Smith's voice booms down from overhead, congratulating the six of us who remain. But he's not inviting us to a feast. He's saying something very confusing. There's been a rule change in the games. A rule change? That in itself is mind-bending, since we don't really have any rules to speak of, except don't step off your circle for 60 seconds and the unspoken rule about not eating one another. Under the new rule, both tributes from the same district will be declared winners if they are the last two alive. Claudius pauses, as if he knows we're not getting it, and repeats the change again. The news sinks in. Two tributes can win this year. If they're from the same district, both can live. Both of us can live. Before I can stop myself, I call out PETA's name. Part 3. The Victor. Chapter 19. I clap my hands over my mouth, but the sound has already escaped. The sky goes black, and I hear a chorus of frogs beginning to sing. Stupid, I tell myself. What a stupid thing to do. I wait, frozen, for the woods to come alive with assailants. Then I remember there's almost no one left. PETA, who's been wounded, is now my ally. Whatever doubts I've had about him dissipate, because if either of us took the other's life now, we'd be pariahs when we returned to District 12. In fact, I know if I was watching, I'd loathe any tribute who didn't immediately ally with their district partner. Besides, it just makes sense to protect each other. And in my case, being one of the star-crossed lovers from District 12, it's an absolute requirement if I want any more help from sympathetic sponsors. The star-crossed lovers. PETA must have been playing that angle all along. Why else would the game makers have made this unprecedented change in the rules? For two tributes to have a shot at winning, our romance must be so popular with the audience that condemning it would jeopardize the success of the games. No thanks to me. All I've done is managed not to kill PETA. But whatever he's done in the arena, he must have the audience convinced it was to keep me alive. Shaking his head to keep me from running to the cornucopia, fighting Cato to let me escape, Even hooking up with the careers must have been a move to protect me. Peeta, it turns out, has never been a danger to me. The thought makes me smile. I drop my hands and hold my face up to the moonlight so the cameras can be sure to catch it. So who is there left to be afraid of? Foxface? The Boyd tribute from her district is dead. She's operating alone, at night, and her strategy has been to evade, not attack. I don't really think that, even if she heard my voice, she'd do anything but hope someone else would kill me. Then there's Thresh. All right, he's a distinct threat. But I haven't seen him, not once, since the games began. I think about how Foxface grew alarmed when she heard a sound at the sight of the explosion. But she didn't turn to the woods. She turned to whatever lies across from it. To that area of the arena that drops off into I don't know what. I feel almost certain that the person she ran from was Thresh, and that is his domain. He'd never have heard me from there, and even if he did, I'm up too high for someone his size to reach. So that leaves Cato and the girl from District 2, who are now surely celebrating the new rule. They're the only ones left who benefit from it, besides Peeta and myself. Do I run from them now, on the chance they heard me call Peeta's name? No, I think. Let them come. Let them come with their night-vision glasses and their heavy branch-breaking bodies. Right into the range of my arrows. But I know they won't. If they didn't come in daylight to my fire, they won't risk what could be another trap at night. When they come, it will be on their own terms, not because I've let them know my whereabouts. Stay put and get some sleep, Katniss, I instruct myself, although I wish I could start tracking Peeta now. Tomorrow, you'll find him. I do sleep, but in the morning I'm extra cautious, thinking that while the careers might hesitate to attack me in a tree, they're completely capable of setting an ambush for me. I make sure to fully prepare myself for the day, eating a big breakfast, securing my pack, readying my weapons, before I descend. But all seems peaceful and undisturbed on the ground. Today I'll have to be scrupulously careful. The careers will know I'm trying to locate Peeta. They may well want to wait until I do before they move in. If he's as badly wounded as Cato thinks, I'd be in the position of having to defend us both without any assistance. But if he's that incapacitated, how has he managed to stay alive? And how on earth will I find him? I try to think of anything Peeta ever said that might give me an indication as to where he's hiding out, but nothing rings a bell. So I go back to the last moment I saw him, sparkling in the sunlight, yelling at me to run. Then Cato appeared, his sword drawn, and after I was gone, he wounded Peeta. But how did Peeta get away? Maybe he'd held out better against the tracker-jacker poison than Cato. Maybe that was the variable that allowed him to escape. But he'd been stung, too. So how far could he have gotten, stabbed and filled with venom? And how has he stayed alive all these days since? If the wound and the stingers haven't killed him, surely thirst would have taken him by now. And that's when I get my first clue to his whereabouts. He couldn't have survived without water. I know that from my first few days here. He must be hidden somewhere near a source. There's the lake, but I find that an unlikely option since it's so close to the career's base camp. A few spring-fed pools, but you'd really be a sitting duck at one of those. And the stream, the one that leads from the camp Ruin I made all the way down near the lake and beyond. If he stuck to the stream, he could change his location and always be near water. He could walk in the current and erase any tracks. He might even be able to get a fish or two. Well, it's a place to start, anyway. To confuse my enemies' minds, I start a fire with plenty of green wood. Even if they think it's a ruse, I hope they'll decide I'm hidden somewhere near it. While in reality, I'll be tracking Peeta. The sun burns off the morning haze almost immediately, and I can tell the day will be hotter than usual. The water's cool and pleasant on my bare feet as I head downstream. I'm tempted to call out Peter's name as I go, but decide against it. I will have to find him with my eyes and one good ear, or he will have to find me. But he'll know I'll be looking, right? He won't have so low an opinion of me as to think I'd ignore the new rule and keep to myself. Would he? He's very hard to predict, which might be interesting under different circumstances, but at the moment only provides an extra obstacle. It doesn't take long to reach the spot where I peeled off to go to the careers camp. There's no sign of Peter, but this doesn't surprise me. I've been up and down this stretch 3 times since the Tracker Jacker incident. If he were nearby, surely I'd have had some suspicion of it. The stream begins to curve to the left into a part of the woods that's new to me. Muddy banks covered in tangled water plants lead to large rocks that increase in size until I begin to feel somewhat trapped. It would be no small matter to escape the stream now, fighting off Cato or Thresh as I climbed over this rocky terrain. In fact, I've just about decided I'm on the wrong track entirely, that a wounded boy would be unable to navigate getting to and from this water source, when I see the bloody streak going down the curve of a boulder. It's long dried now, but the smeary lines running side to side suggest someone who perhaps was not fully in control of his mental faculties, tried to wipe it away. Hugging the rocks, I move slowly in the direction of the blood, searching for him. I find a few more bloodstains, one with a few threads of fabric glued to it, but no sign of life. I break down and say his name in a hushed voice. Peter! Peter! Then a mockingjay lands on a scruffy tree and begins to mimic my tones. So I stop. I give up and climb back down to the stream, thinking he must have moved on, somewhere farther down. My foot has just broken the surface of the water when I hear a voice.
You here to finish me off, sweetheart?
I whip around. It's come from the left, so I can't pick it up very well, and the voice was hoarse and weak. Still, it must have been Peter. Who else in the arena would call me sweetheart? My eyes peruse the bank, but there's nothing. Just mud, the plants, the base of the rocks.
Peter,
I whisper,
where are you?
There's no answer. Could I just have imagined it? No, I'm certain it was real and very close at hand, too.
Peter,
I creep along the bank.
Well, don't step on me.
I jump back. His voice was right under my feet. Still, there's nothing. Then his eyes open, unmistakably blue in the brown mud and green leaves. I gasp, and am rewarded with a hint of white teeth as he laughs. It's the final word in camouflage. Forget trucking weights around. Peter should have gone into his private session with the game makers and painted himself into a tree, or a boulder, or a muddy bank full of weeds. Close your eyes again, I order. He does, and his mouth, too, and completely disappears. Most of what I judge to be his body is actually under a layer of mud and plants. His face and arms are so artfully disguised as to be invisible. I kneel beside him. I guess all those hours decorating cakes paid off. Peter smiles.
Yes, frosting. The final defense of the dying.
You're not going to die, I tell him firmly.
Says who?
His voice is so ragged.
Says me. We're on the same team now, you know, I tell him. His eyes open.
So I heard. Nice of you to find what's left of me.
I pull out my water bottle and give him a drink.
Did Cato cut you?
I ask.
Left leg. A pie,
he answers. Let's get you in the stream, wash you off, so I can see what kind of wounds you've got, I say.
Lean down a minute first,
he says.
Need to tell you something.
I lean over and put my good ear to his lips, which tickle as he whispers.
Remember, we're madly in love, so it's all right to kiss me any time you feel like it.
I jerk my head back, but end up laughing. Thanks, I'll keep it in mind. At least, he's still able to joke around. But when I start to help him to the stream, all the levity disappears. It's only 2 feet away. How hard can it be? Very hard when I realize he's unable to move an inch on his own. He's so weak that the best he can do is not to resist. I try to drag him, but despite the fact that I know he's doing all he can to keep quiet, sharp cries of pain escape him. The mud and plants seem to have imprisoned him, and I finally have to give a gigantic tug to break him from their clutches. He's still 2 feet from the water, lying there, teeth gritted, tears cutting trails in the dirt on his face. Look, Peeta, I'm going to roll you into the stream. It's very shallow here, okay? I say.
Excellent, he says.
I crouch down beside him. No matter what happens, I tell myself, don't stop until he's in the water. On three, I say. One, two, three. I can only manage one full roll before I have to stop because of the horrible sound he's making. Now he's on the edge of the stream. Maybe this is better anyway. Okay, change of plans. I'm not going to put you all the way in, I tell him. Besides, if I get him in, who knows if I'd ever be able to get him out.
No more rolling? He asks.
That's all done. Let's get you cleaned up. Keep an eye on the woods for me, okay? I say. It's hard to know where to start. He's so caked with mud and matted leaves, I can't even see his clothes. If he's wearing clothes. The thought makes me hesitate a moment, but then I plunge in. Naked bodies are no big deal in the arena, right? I've got 2 water bottles and Rue's water skin. I prop them against rocks in the stream so that 2 are always filling while I pour the 3rd over Peeta's body. It takes a while, but I finally get rid of enough mud to find his clothes. I gently unzip his jacket, unbutton his shirt, and ease them off him. His undershirt is so plastered into his wounds, I have to cut it away with my knife and drench him again to work it loose. He's badly bruised, with a long burn across his chest and 4 tracker-jacker stings, if you count the one under his ear. But I feel a bit better. This much I can fix. I decide to take care of his upper body first, to alleviate some pain, before I tackle whatever damage Cato did to his leg. Since treating his wounds seems pointless when he's lying in what's become a mud puddle, I manage to prop him up against a boulder. He sits there, uncomplaining, while I wash away all the traces of dirt from his hair and skin. His flesh is very pale in the sunlight, and he no longer looks strong and stocky. I have to dig the stingers out of his tracker-jacker lumps, which causes him to wince, but the minute I apply the leaves, he sighs in relief. While he dries in the sun, I wash his filthy shirt and jacket and spread them over boulders. Then I apply the burn cream to his chest. This is when I notice how hot his skin is becoming. The layer of mud and the bottles of water have disguised the fact that he's burning with fever. I dig through the first aid kit I got from the boy from District 1 and find pills that reduce your temperature. My mother actually breaks down and buys these on occasion when her home remedies fail. Swallow these, I tell him, and he obediently takes the medicine. You must be hungry.
Not really. It's funny. I haven't been hungry for days, says Peeta.
In fact, when I offer him Grusling, he wrinkles his nose at it and turns away. That's when I know how sick he is. Peeta, we need to get some food in you, I insist.
It'll just come right back up, he says.
The best I can do is to get him to eat a few bits of dried apple.
Thanks. I'm much better, really. Can I sleep now, Katniss?
He asks. Soon, I promise. I need to look at your leg first. Trying to be as gentle as I can, I remove his boots, his socks, and then very slowly inch his pants off of him. I can see the tear Cato's sword made in the fabric over his thigh. But it in no way prepares me for what lies underneath. The deep inflamed gash, oozing both blood and pus, the swelling of the leg, and worst of all, the smell of festering flesh. I want to run away, disappear into the woods, like I did that day they brought the burn victim to our house. Go and hunt while my mother and Prim attend to what I have neither the skill nor the courage to face. But there's no one here but me. I try to capture the calm demeanor my mother assumes when handling particularly bad cases.
Pretty awful, huh?
Says Peeta. He's watching me closely.
So-so.
I shrug, like it's no big deal.
You should see some of the people they bring my mother from the mines.
I refrain from saying how I usually clear out of the house whenever she's treating anything worse than a cold. Come to think of it, I don't even much like to be around coughing.
First thing is to clean it well.
I've left on Peeta's undershorts because they're not in bad shape, and I don't want to pull them over the swollen thigh. And, all right, maybe the idea of him being naked makes me uncomfortable. That's another thing about my mother and Prim. Nakedness has no effect on them, gives them no cause for embarrassment. Ironically, at this point in the games, my little sister would be of far more use to Peeta than I am. I scoot my square of plastic under him so I can wash down the rest of him. With each bottle I pour over him, the worse the wound looks. The rest of his lower body has fared pretty well, just one tracker-jacker sting and a few small burns that I treat quickly. But the gash on his leg, what on earth can I do for that?
Why don't we give it some air and then...
I trail off.
And then you'll patch it up?
Says Peeta. He looks almost sorry for me, as if he knows how lost I am.
That's right, I say. In the meantime, you eat these.
I put a few dried pear halves in his hand and go back in the stream to wash the rest of his clothes. When they're flattened out and drying, I examine the contents of the first aid kit. It's pretty basic stuff. Bandages, fever pills, medicine to calm stomachs. Nothing of the caliber I'll need to treat Peeta.
We're going to have to experiment some, I admit.
I know the Tracker Jacker leaves draw out infection, so I start with those, within minutes of pressing the handful of chewed-up green stuff into the wound. Pus begins running down the side of his leg. I tell myself this is a good thing, and bite the inside of my cheek hard, because my breakfast is threatening to make a reappearance.
Katniss,
Peeta says. I meet his eyes, knowing my face must be some shade of green. He mouths the words.
How about that kiss?
I burst out laughing because the whole thing is so revolting I can't stand it.
Something wrong?
He asks, a little too innocently.
I'm no good at this. I'm not my mother. I've no idea what I'm doing, and I hate pus, I say. Ugh!
I allow myself to let out a groan as I rinse away the first round of leaves and apply the second.
Oh!
How do you hunt?
He asks. Trust me, killing things is much easier than this, I said.
Although for all I know, I am killing you.
Can you speed it up a little?
He asks. No, shut up and eat your pears, I say. After three applications, and what seems like a bucket of pus, the wound does look better. Now that the swelling has gone down, I can see how deep Cato's sword cut, right down to the bone.
What next, Dr. Everdeen?
He asks. Maybe I'll put some of the burn ointment on it, I think it helps with infection anyway. And wrap it up? I say.
I do, and the whole thing seems a lot more manageable, covered in clean white cotton. Although, against the sterile bandage, the hem of his undershorts look filthy and teeming with contagion. I pull out Rue's backpack.
Here, cover yourself with this, and I'll wash your shorts.
Oh, I don't care if you see me, says Peeta.
You're just like the rest of my family, I say. I care, all right? I turn my back and look at the stream until the undershorts splash into the current. He must be feeling a bit better if he can throw.
You know, you're kind of squeamish for such a lethal person, says Peeta as I beat the shorts clean between two rocks. I wish I'd let you give Haymitch a shower after all.
I wrinkle my nose at the memory. What's he sent you so far?
Not a thing, says Peeta.
Then there's a pause as it hits him.
Why, did you get something?
Burn medicine, I say almost sheepishly. Oh, and some bread.
I always knew you were his favorite, says Peeta.
Please, he can't stand being in the same room with me, I say.
Because you're just alike,
mutters Peeta. I ignore it, though, because this isn't really the time for me to be insulting Haymitch, which is my first impulse. I let Peeta doze off while his clothes dry out, but by late afternoon, I don't dare wait any longer. I gently shake his shoulder.
Peeta, we've got to go now.
Go?
He seems confused.
Go where?
Away from here, downstream maybe. Somewhere we can hide you until you're stronger, I say.
I help him dress, leaving his feet bare so we can walk in the water, and pull him upright. His face drains of color the moment he puts weight on his leg.
Come on, you can do this.
But he can't. Not for long, anyway. We make it about 50 yards downstream, with him propped up by my shoulder, and I can tell he's going to black out. I sit him on the bank, push his head between his knees, and pat his back awkwardly as I survey the area. Of course, I'd love to get him up in a tree, but that's not going to happen. It could be worse, though. Some of the rocks form small cave-like structures. I set my sights on one about 20 yards above the stream. When Peeta's able to stand, I half-guide, half-carry him up to the cave. Really, I'd like to look around for a better place, but this one will have to do because my ally is shot, paper white, panting, and even though it's only just cooling off, he's shivering. I cover the floor of the cave with a layer of pine needles, unroll my sleeping bag, and tuck him into it. I get a couple of pills and some water into him when he's not noticing, but he refuses to eat even the fruit. Then he just lies there, his eyes trained on my face as I build a sort of blind out of vines to conceal the mouth of the cave. The result is unsatisfactory. An animal might not question it, but a human would see hands had manufactured it quickly enough. I tear it down in frustration.
Katniss,
he says. I go over to him and brush the hair back from his eyes.
Thanks for finding me.
You would have found me if you could, I say, his forehead's burning up. Like the medicine's having no effect at all. Suddenly out of nowhere, I'm scared he's going to die.
Yes. Look, if I don't make it back,
he begins. Don't talk like that. I didn't drain all that pus for nothing, I say.
I know, but just in case I don't.
He tries to continue.
No, Peeta, I don't even want to discuss it,
I say, placing my fingers on his lips to quiet him.
But I...
He insists. Impulsively, I lean forward and kiss him, stopping his words. This is probably overdue anyway, since he's right. We are supposed to be madly in love. It's the first time I've ever kissed a boy, which should make some sort of impression, I guess. But all I can register is how unnaturally hot his lips are from the fever. I break away, a
and pull the edge of the sleeping bag up around him. You're not going to die. I forbid it. All right?
All right,
he whispers. I step out in the cool evening air, just as the parachute floats down from the sky. My fingers quickly undo the tie, hoping for some real medicine to treat Peter's leg. Instead, I find a pot of hot broth. Haymitch couldn't be sending me a clearer message. One kiss equals one pot of broth. I can almost hear his snarl.
You're supposed to be in love, sweetheart. The boy's dying. Give me something I can work with.
And he's right. If I want to keep Peter alive, I've got to give the audience something more to care about. Star-crossed lovers desperate to get home together, two hearts beating as one. Romance. Never having been in love, this is going to be a real trick. I think of my parents, the way my father never failed to bring her gifts from the woods, the way my mother's face would light up at the sound of his boots at the door, the way she almost stopped living when he died. Peter, I say, trying for the special tone that my mother used only with my father. He's dozed off again, but I kiss him awake, which seems to startle him. Then he smiles as if he'd be happy to lie there gazing at me forever. He's great at this stuff. I hold up the pot.
Peter, look what Haymitch has sent you.
Chapter 20. Getting the broth into Peter takes an hour of coaxing, begging, threatening, and yes, kissing. But finally, sip by sip, he empties the pot. I let him drift off to sleep then, and attend to my own needs, wolfing down a supper of grousling and roots while I watch the daily report in the sky. No new casualties. Still, Peter and I have given the audience a fairly interesting day. Hopefully, the game makers will allow us a peaceful night. I automatically look around for a good tree to nest in before I realize that's over. At least for a while, I can't very well leave Peter unguarded on the ground. I left the scene of his last hiding place on the bank of the stream untouched. How could I conceal it? And we're a scant 50 yards downstream. I put on my glasses, place my weapons in readiness, and settle down to keep watch. The temperature drops rapidly, and soon I'm chilled to the bone. Eventually, I give in and slide into the sleeping bag with Peter. It's toasty warm, and I snuggle down gratefully, until I realize it's more than warm. It's overly hot, because the bag is reflecting back his fever. I check his forehead and find it burning and dry. I don't know what to do. Leave him in the bag and hope the excessive heat breaks the fever? Take him out and hope the night air cools him off? I end up just dampening a strip of bandage and placing it on his forehead. It seems weak, but I'm afraid to do anything too drastic. I spend the night half sitting, half lying next to Peter, refreshing the bandage and trying not to dwell on the fact that by teaming up with him, I've made myself far more vulnerable than when I was alone. Tethered to the ground, on guard, with a very sick person to take care of. But I knew he was injured, and still I came after him. I'm just going to have to trust that whatever instinct sent me to find him was a good one. When the sky turns rosy, I notice the sheen of sweat on Peter's lip and discover the fever has broken. He's not back to normal, but it's come down a few degrees. Last night, when I was gathering vines, I came upon a bush of bruised berries. I strip off the fruit and mash it up in the broth pot with cold water. Peter's struggling to get up when I reach the cave.
I woke up and you were gone, he says. I was worried about you.
I have to laugh as I ease him back down. You were worried about me? Have you taken a look at yourself lately?
I thought Cato and Clove might have found you. They like to hunt at night, he says, still serious.
Clove? Which one is that? I ask.
The girl from District 2. She's still alive, right?
He says. Yes, there's just them and us and Thresh and Foxface, I say. That's what I nicknamed the girl from 5. How do you feel?
Better than yesterday. This is an enormous improvement over the mud, he says. Clean clothes and medicine and a sleeping bag. And you?
Oh, right. The whole romance thing. I reach out to touch his cheek, and he catches my hand and presses it against his lips. I remember my father doing this very thing to my mother, and I wonder where Peeta picked it up. Surely not from his father and the witch. No more kisses for you until you've eaten, I say. We get him propped up against the wall, and he obediently swallows the spoonfuls of the berry mush I feed him. He refuses the gruesling again, though.
You didn't sleep, Peeta says.
I'm all right, I say, but the truth is, I'm exhausted.
Sleep now. I'll keep watch. I'll wake you if anything happens, he says.
I hesitate.
Katniss, you can't stay up forever.
He's got a point there. I'll have to sleep eventually, and probably better to do it now, when he seems relatively alert, and we have daylight on our side. All right, I say, but just for a few hours. Then you wake me. It's too warm for the sleeping bag now. I smooth it out on the cave floor and lie down, one hand on my loaded bow in case I have to shoot at a moment's notice. Peeta sits beside me, leaning against the wall, his bad leg stretched out before him, his eyes trained on the world outside.
Go to sleep, he says softly.
His hand brushes the loose strands of my hair off my forehead. Unlike the staged kisses and caresses so far, this gesture seems natural and comforting. I don't want him to stop, and he doesn't. He's still stroking my hair when I fall asleep. Too long. I sleep too long. I know from the moment I open my eyes that we're into the afternoon. Peter's right beside me, his position unchanged. I sit up, feeling somehow defensive, but better rested than I've been in days. Peeta, you were supposed to wake me after a couple of hours, I say.
For what? Nothing's going on here, he says. Besides, I like watching you sleep. You don't scowl. Improves your looks a lot.
This, of course, brings on a scowl that makes him grin. That's when I notice how dry his lips are. I test his cheek, hot as a coal stove. He claims he's been drinking, but the containers still feel full to me. I give him more fever pills and stand over him while he drinks first one, then a second quart of water. Then I tend to his minor wounds, the burns, the stings, which are showing improvement. I steel myself and unwrap the leg. My heart drops into my stomach. It's worse, much worse. There's no more pus in evidence, but the swelling has increased and the tight, shiny skin is inflamed. Then I see the red streaks starting to crawl up his leg. Blood poisoning. Unchecked, it will kill him for sure. My chewed-up leaves and ointment won't make a dent in it. We'll need strong anti-infection drugs from the capital. I can't imagine the cost of such potent medicine. If Haymitch pulled every donation from every sponsor, would he have enough? I doubt it. Gifts go up in price the longer the games continue. What buys a full meal on day 1 buys a cracker on day 12. And the kind of medicine Peeta needs would have been at a premium from the beginning.
Well, there's more swelling, but the pus is gone, I say in an unsteady voice. I know what blood poisoning is, Katniss, says Peeta, even if my mother isn't a healer.
You're just going to have to outlast the others, Peeta. They'll cure it back at the capital when we win, I say.
Yes. That's a good plan, he says,
but I feel this is mostly for my benefit. You have to eat. Keep your strength up. I'm going to make you soup, I say.
Don't light a fire, he says. It's not worth it.
We'll see, I say. As I take the pot down to the stream, I'm struck by how brutally hot it is. I swear the game makers are progressively ratcheting up the temperature in the daytime and sending it plummeting at night. The heat of the sun-baked stones by the stream gives me an idea, though. Maybe I won't need to light a fire. I settle down on a big, flat rock halfway between the stream and the cave. After purifying half a pot of water, I place it in direct sunlight and add several egg-size hot stones to the water. I'm the first to admit I'm not much of a cook, but since soup mainly involves tossing everything in a pot and waiting, it's one of my better dishes. I mince grousling until it's practically mush, and mash some of Rue's roots. Fortunately, they've both been roasted already, so they mostly need to be heated up. Already between the sunlight and the rocks, the water's warm. I put in the meat and roots, swap in fresh rocks, and go find something green to spice it up a little. Before long, I discover a tuft of chives growing at the base of some rocks. Perfect. I chop them very fine and add them to the pot, switch out the rocks again, put on the lid, and let the whole thing stew. I've seen very few signs of game around, but I don't feel comfortable leaving Peeta alone while I hunt, so I rig half a dozen snares and hope I get lucky. I wonder about the other tributes, how they're managing now that their main source of food has been blown up. At least three of them, Cato, Clove, and Foxface, have been relying on it. Probably not Thresh, though. I've got a feeling he must share some of Rue's knowledge on how to feed yourself from the earth. Are they fighting each other? Looking for us? Maybe one of them has located us and is just waiting for the right moment to attack. The idea sends me back to the cave. Peeta's stretched out on top of the sleeping bag in the shade of the rocks. Although he brightens a bit when I come in, it's clear he feels miserable. I put cool cloths on his head, but they warm up almost as soon as they touch his skin. Do you want anything? I ask.
No, he says. Thank you. Wait, yes. Tell me a story.
A story? What about? I say. I'm not much for storytelling. It's kind of like singing, but once in a while, Prim wheedles one out of me.
Something happy. Tell me about the happiest day you can remember, says Peeta.
Something between a sigh and a huff of exasperation leaves my mouth. A happy story? This will require a lot more effort than the soup. I rack my brains for good memories. Most of them involve Gale and me out hunting, and somehow I don't think these will play well with either Peeta or the audience. That leaves Prim. Did I ever tell you about how I got Prim's goat? I ask. Peeta shakes his head and looks at me expectantly. So I begin, but carefully, because my words are going out all over Panem. And while people have no doubt put two and two together that I hunt illegally, I don't want to hurt Gale or Greasy Say or the butcher or even the peacekeepers back home who are my customers by publicly announcing they're breaking the law too. Here's the real story of how I got the money for Prim's goat lady. It was a Friday evening, the day before Prim's 10th birthday in late May. As soon as school ended, Gale and I hit the woods because I wanted to get enough to trade for a present for Prim. Maybe some new cloth for a dress or a hairbrush. Our snares had done well enough and the woods were flush with greens, but this was really no more than our average Friday night haul. I was disappointed as we headed back, even though Gale said we'd be sure to do better tomorrow. We were resting a moment by a stream when we saw him. A young buck, probably a yearling by his size. His antlers were just growing in, still small and coated in velvet, poised to run but unsure of us, unfamiliar with humans, beautiful. less beautiful perhaps, when the two arrows caught him, one in the neck, the other in the chest. Gale and I had shot at the same time. The buck tried to run, but stumbled.